For the week of June 22nd, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 241, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York at the Zoe Institute for Theater and Film, I'm Michael Giltz.
You see, the problem with doing that, Michael, is that all of our listeners are now going to flood onto Google. They're going to run to Google and try and look up the Zoe, what, Art Institute? I don't even know what you said. Institute for Art and Film or something like that?
All right, I'm at my friend's apartment.
Okay. Not that, you know, we really have to be that accurate, but, you know, I figured the Zoe Institute of, what did you call it?
I don't remember. Theater and Film.
Okay, yeah.
She's doing casting for a film today, even as we speak. I'm in her apartment recording my show because I am a vagabond right now. She was at the theater over the weekend. I'm going to the theater tonight. So it just feels like a theater related thing. And in fact, speaking of the theater, he's got his first show on Broadway. Jerry Goffin, the great composer, died over last week. Right now on Broadway is Beautiful, the Carole King story, a musical about her life. And of course, she was at one point married to Jerry Goffin, and the show shows his cheating on her and drug addiction, but their eventual rapprochement, if that's the right word. And she gave a lovely little statement talking about Jerry and what a great songwriter and person he was. So that was sort of it's a funny, bittersweet ending to that relationship. There is a show that charts their marriage disintegration on Broadway, but is a commercial triumph and showcases the songs that he'll always be remembered for.
And so just to clarify, he wasn't a composer of Broadway shows. He was a kind of a pop
songs that are now being used in a Broadway show, like On Broadway, and of course, a lot of the Carole King hits, the songs that they wrote for girl groups and bands over the years. And then, of course, she became a solo act and one of the biggest solo acts of all time.
And then, of course, the show kind of charts, as you say, their marriage and disintegration of the marriage, which is why Carole King didn't want to see it.
Right. She's like, I lived that. I don't need to see that. And another person who died this week is not as famous, perhaps, but he's known in the industry, and that's Anthony Goldschmidt.
Yes, he was 71 years old, and he did probably more posters than anybody. I mean, he did the posters for E.T., Apollo 13, Rain Man, The Color Purple, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Thelma and Louise, Empire of the Sun. I could keep going and going and going because his filmography, if you will, his resume is, he's literally, he is iconic. His movie posters are iconic.
Right. You know, if you name a movie and can picture their poster like E.T. or Rain Man, or for me, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, that's saying something. You did a good job of capturing that film. And actually, one of his that I didn't really care for was Thelma and Louise, which is, an Oscar nominated, or did it win an Oscar? I can't remember. But Thelma and Louise, of course, the Susan Sarandon, Gina Davis movie. And in the obituaries, I saw him talk about how hard that was to do for that movie, because it's kind of a dark film. There's a rape at the beginning of the film. They go off. There's a suicide at the end. But he said you couldn't really capture that in the poster, and they ended up doing this sunny, cheerful poster, which, you know, worked for selling the film. But whenever I saw it, I found a disconnect between that and what the film actually was. I didn't feel like it captured it, but it did its job commercially. And I thought it was interesting that he talked about that film in particular and the challenges he faced creating it.
I remember actually going to see that movie opening night in the theater only because it was a Ridley Scott film.
Sure.
But I remember thinking, I don't know anything about this movie, and it looks like some bad comedy. And,
yeah.
and I walked out thinking, going, this was one of the greatest movies I've ever seen.
Well, I wouldn't say that for me, but
I was like 20. Come on.
Well, you probably did. Well, okay. Even at 20, I didn't say that. But you probably left saying, and that guy had really nice abs.
Oh, you're talking about Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt stole the film as a boy toy for one of the women. I think it was it Sarandon?
It was Gina Davis.
It was Gina Davis. No, you're right. Yeah, well, there you go. So Anthony Schmidt, a great poster designer, did also other stuff. He had a company. He won an Emmy nomination for doing title design, like Saul Bass. That was for the 1976 TV movie Eleanor and Franklin.
Yes.
And a great career. So if he designed a poster for us, I'm not sure what it would look like, but if he had to listen to the show in order to create the poster, what would he be hearing about this week?
Well, on this week's show, we'll be asking whether filmmakers owning the movies they make is going to become a new trend.
Nope.
Up in well,
there you
okay.
go. I just saved you 10 minutes.
Up until now, of course, directors, even big names like Peter Jackson and James Cameron.
Move on to the other stories.
Well, let me just finish. Well, I'll explain this. You know, they mostly... They take
we'll explain
up front
it when
fees.
We do the story.
Okay, fine. I'll move on to the next bit. Wow. You know, I'm trying to, you know, breeze through the intro here, go through all the teases and...
Sorry.
All righty. Well, you know, we'll also tell you how, or at the very least why, the vinyl LP version of Jack White's new album managed to sell 40,000 copies in its first week, or as Michael likes to call it, a pittance. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll end with some discussion about a dispute between YouTube and some indie record labels, which has been getting a lot of buzz over the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. I am sure to interrupt him several times.
I hope so. We're talking about the worldwide box office, of course. We get our information from Rentrak. We include a link to their website in our show notes. We also pull info from The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, The LA Times, wherever we find it. So we're looking at worldwide box office, and the number one movie around the world is How to Train Your Dragon 2, another $68 million. It's at $172 million worldwide and counting. At number two, as we predicted, Maleficent, $57 million. It blew past the $500 million mark, and it is now Angelina Jolie's most successful film of all time, a great precursor to her having her directorial film Unbroken open towards the end of the year with Oscar hopes in its eyes. At number three is 22 Jump Street, another $43 million. That's at $150 million worldwide, a lot of that in North America. That's a very successful R-rated comedy. At number four is Tom Cruise.
Think about it this way, okay? 22 Jump Street,
yeah,
okay, has made... In North America only, I'm just going to go with North America, $111 million, okay?
Yeah.
How to Train Your Dragon 2, $95 million. I would have pegged How to Train Your Dragon 2 to have made more money in its second by its second weekend than 22 Jump Street.
That's right, but as we always say, it doesn't matter where a film starts. It doesn't matter how another film does compared to it. When they opened on the same, it doesn't matter. What matters is how much it costs to make. And how much it ends up making.
Can you explain that to the U.S. men's national soccer team or football team? Because they seem to think somehow that if you're ahead 2-1, you stop playing.
They didn't stop playing, but definitely the tie felt like a loss.
Yes.
And talk about a sea change in TV ratings. Soccer has been played by kids for decades in North America, but they don't stay with the sport because there's no money in it. Very few people go on to professional soccer because we have leagues and stuff, but it's just not that high profile. We've gotten spikes with the women, and we've gotten spikes with this and that, and we have Landon Donovan, who's the best-known U.S. player of all time, but not a great TV commentator. He's got to work on that.
Oh, God.
But you looked at this World Cup, and you saw it when the World Cup was in Berlin. There was a lot of attention paid. People were really starting to focus. This is it. This is the tipping point. People are really watching World Cup. It's in the right time zone. But I'm sorry, when you have thousands of people in a park in Chicago watching World Cup, that is new. I mean, this it should have happened a long time ago. This is, you know, a country of immigrants. People come from all over the world. They all love soccer all over the world. And it's great to see it really come of age here in North America. I don't think we're going to go back ever again. I think it's going to get bigger and bigger. If we go farther in the U.S. men's team, that will certainly help interest and excitement for both the leagues that exist now and kids who want to make soccer their career. And that could have a big effect in the, you know, the 10 or 20 years to come.
So would beating Portugal, but, you know.
Yeah, it's going to be tough, but they got an injured player, and, you know, we got injured players. We'll see what happens. At number four around the world, if you're not at watching your football, you can go to the movies in between games, of course. You can see Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow, $31 million worldwide. It's just under $300 million in counting.
And not to interrupt you with yet another tributary, Edge of Tomorrow, great movie. Go see it.
Yes. And number five, the number one film in North America is Think Like a Man 2, another Kevin Hart success story. It opened to $30 million in North America. Whether it ever opens up anywhere else is yet to be seen. It cost $24 million to make. It will be profitable no matter what happens as far as the rest of the world is concerned. But again, you've got this guy's a big star in North America. You want to invest in him and make him a worldwide star like Eddie Murphy and Will Smith and other black actors. Why not do it? I don't get it.
And
number six is The Fault in Our Stars. $28 million, well into the black on this film. $160 million worldwide and counting. And overseas is starting to catch up with North America.
Yeah, I'm surprised. This film dropped another 40-something percent and is 41% here in North America.
So what? It's making $100 million in North America. Whether it's front-loaded or not, who cares?
I thought it would have some legs. I don't know why.
But you know what? If it opened to $8 million and ran for 15 weeks, that would be better for the theater owners, of course. But if it ran for 8 weeks and 10 weeks and made steady $8 million, you say, oh, what a great success story. It ended up making $100 million. It only cost $12 million to make.
Yeah.
It's grossed $100 million in North America. Success!
That's right.
Obviously, you want it to have good word of mouth and people to flock to it. But if everybody goes opening weekend, then everybody goes opening weekend.
Right.
Right? What matters is the final amount. And I think the fans who saw it liked it. I haven't heard any, I don't know about the audience scores. That stuff seems so vague to me. But the people I know who saw it were like, oh, I cried. All the women I know who saw it cried. They were so happy.
Well, listen, just don't tell me how it ends.
At number seven is X-Men Days of Future Past, another $17 million. It's just about to blow past $700 million worldwide. By far the most successful X-Men film. But of course, it's by far the most expensive X-Men film. You know, it cost $200 million to make. You look at the last four or five movies, they didn't make their money in worldwide box office. However, they made money on the X-Men films. It wasn't at the box office because most of them look like they barely broke even or lost money. If you do the simple arithmetic of what it cost and how much it made worldwide and assume they pulled in about half of that. So I don't know where they're making the money on the X-Men films, but you know, this one now is edging into profitability because it costs $200 million to make. And that means you got to make what, about $300 million? You know, what you pull back, which means $600 million in box office gross?
Roughly, yeah. You probably have to make about $600 million.
Or a little bit more because, you know, marketing and you don't get 50% in other markets necessarily.
True.
So it's $700 million. It's just about edging into the black, which means this will be a valuable part of their library, very valuable on video on demand and digital downloads and Blu-ray and TV showings and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you want to own a part of that.
And number eight is Godzilla. It's made another $16 million. That's at $477 million worldwide. That's out of the... Well, it's just still in the top 10 in North America, and it cost $160 million to make, so that's just about to edge into profitability as well. Right?
Between $300 and $400 million, you can... they're breaking even.
Well, but they spent a lot to market that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it's $500 million? Yeah, no, they're done. Yeah.
It costs $160 million to make, big marketing budget, big worldwide opening release. So, you know, that's just edging into the black. And again, it's sort of a mixed blessing on that film. It had opened a lot stronger than it's ending up. Number nine is Jersey Boys. Not a success story, is it? But maybe it is. This is Clint Eastwood, based on a big Broadway hit. It grossed $15 million, almost all of it in North America, just a little bit overseas, but it only costs $40 million to make.
Right. So if this film hits $100 million
worldwide,
it will be
okay.
It'll be okay.
Right. So again, you know, they had high hopes, perhaps, and it is a big Tony winning musical, a big success story. A lot of people have seen the show. The film, however, got mixed reviews. You know, the adults are not going to turn out opening weekend, and that's who's going to see this movie. On the other hand, you want to get good reviews to get those adults to show up. Maybe word of mouth will be good. We'll have to see. But not a big success, but it's certainly not a disaster because it didn't cost a lot to make. And at number 10, a movie that did not do great either is Blended. Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, still out there somewhere in 37 markets. It made $7 million, and it's at $63 million worldwide. It's towards the end of its run, I assume, right? It only costs $40 million to make, but believe me, that does not include the back end that Sandler and Barrymore were going to get, whatever that was. You know, $40 million budget? Adam Sandler? Come on.
I don't think they're getting first dollar gross on this one.
Well, what do you mean? Either you are or you aren't.
No, I don't think they are.
Well, no, but they're not. But they're not taking $5 million to make a romantic comedy. They're third pairing.
I don't know. I mean,
it's Adam Sandler. He normally would get like $10-15 million, $20 million, right?
Not after his last couple movies.
If this movie's budgeted at $40 million, he's getting money on the back end. He has to be.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Well, how else did they make it for $40 million?
Whether he gets first dollar gross is one. In other words, do we give him a piece of every dollar?
Why would he make the movie? He's been a big box office draw. If he took a huge cut in his salary, which he obviously did to make the film at $40 million, clearly he had to get stuff on the back end. And he's not going to take net.
No.
Right. So clearly this movie is a million miles away from profitability.
Oh, well, then maybe it's closer to A Million Ways to Die?
Well, that's at number 12. That made $71 million worldwide. It's chugging along, but yeah, I don't know what other territories it has left. But that too did not cost a lot to make, and there's probably not a lot of profit participation, but it costs $40 million, so they're not going to lose their shirts, just like Blended, but they're not going to make a lot either. And that's where we are at the box office. Kevin Hart, he's the number one film in North America. He's a big star. I don't know why they don't invest in him and release his films overseas.
I would agree. They did it with Eddie Murphy, right?
Right. So, of course, he was always paired with white actors. I mean, I don't know.
48 Hours and all, yeah.
Yeah.
another 48 hours and true.
And yet another, right. So we were talking a lot here about profitability because that's how we measure a film's success, separate from our love of whether a movie is good or not.
Well, and by the way, I did say that Edge of Tomorrow is great. I know that you have a different measuring stick or barometer for that. It's a good movie, though.
Well, it may well be on your best of the year list, right?
It might be, depending on what else comes
out.
Well,
is it worthy of it? Is it worthy of it?
Right now,
either
yes.
Either it is or it isn't.
Right now, it is.
All right. Well, but no. Either it's a good enough movie to be on your best of the year list or it's not.
I wouldn't be ashamed if it was.
Right, okay. I would say you see a movie in January. If it's a really good film, you're like, this will be on my best of the year. You can say that. If it's a borderline bubble film, then it's not that good a movie. But everybody I know who's seen it likes it.
Yes.
And everybody I know who's seen Boyhood by Richard Linklater likes that too. It's a $5 million independent film.
$5 billion?
$5 million independent film. It was shot over a 12-year period to capture the growth of a child, kind of a fascinating way to make a film. They film for like a couple weeks?
Just a couple days every single year. Yeah.
Every single year. Kind of neat. And we'll have to see if this is a profitable film, but it's certainly getting good reviews.
It got great reviews out of Sundance. It got great reviews out of Berlin. It's doing, review-wise, it's doing great.
But is it a trendsetter?
Okay, so what we're talking about here, and we were talking about profitability, and that's the direction we were headed before I rudely interrupted you to talk about Edge of Tomorrow one more time. Really, there was a story in The Hollywood Reporter about how John Sloss, who's a lawyer and he is a sales rep, a sales agent for independent filmmakers and independent films. And what he did for this film, rather than have Richard Linklater take his full salary, which he never would have gotten on this film. I think, Michael, during the pre-show, you and I both agreed, Richard Linklater was never going to make $1 million, a low seven-figure salary, on a $5 million movie.
Well, it's a labor of love film.
Right. He was never going to make that. But he said, you know what? Give me some ownership. And rather than, points, give me some, I'll be one of the owners, much like IFC, which is releasing the film, and IFC Films, which is financing the film. I will be one of the owners. And I will, instead of collecting royalties, will actually share in the revenues, all the revenues from every single distribution channel.
So he started filming this in what, 2002?
Two.
Right before he made School of Rock, his biggest commercial hit, I believe.
Yes. Well, maybe the Midnight
Bad
films?
News, or Bad News Bears? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, certainly School of Rock was a huge hit. My kids love that movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a labor of love. And he said, well, obviously I'm not going to get paid a decent salary for this. Why don't I just take a cut of the film?
Right. And you didn't want me to explain it earlier, but mostly directors are, and like I said, even big names like Spielberg and Peter Jackson and James Cameron, they almost always take upfront fees and then get royalties. And then they, of course,
it's the old adage, do not invest in your own musical. When you're on Broadway, never invest in your own show.
Right. So why would they take the money on the back end now when in previous, previously you had to fight tooth and nail to get an honest accounting from the studios, even though they always say, no movie makes profits. The big joke about Paramount, why can't they play tennis at Paramount?
Why?
They can't find the nets.
Very fun.
That's an Art Buckwald joke.
Yeah, there we go.
Art Buckwell,
he was involved. That was Coming to America. He was involved. No, what was his
Coming to America? You're absolutely correct.
Oh, it was. Okay, great.
Yes.
So he had a big fight with them, where we hopefully got to open the books.
Right, and then so they,
Sorry, you're getting off the fee here. What's going on? So Richard Linklater took a piece of the film,
and now the
Hollywood Reporter story is suggesting that this is a trend.
Well, they're asking, is this a new trend? Because what with all these co-financing deals with Relativity co-financing not just one movie but a slate of movies, like 15, 20, 60 movies.
Well, I thought we were talking about artists, like directors and actors.
Well, right,
not investment firms.
That's
why are you talking about investors?
Well, we're talking about investors because the studio is trying to lay off some of the risk, right? And so to do that, they're doing it with co-financiers, and Legendary is a good example, Village Roadshow another example, Relativity. But they have to provide an honest accounting, a more transparent accounting.
But that's not new. I've been hearing about studios laying off risk for decades.
Yes, but the way they did it was they would sell the entire country of France or the entire rest of the world, and they would keep North America.
But didn't Disney do those lame investor things where you'd invest in a slate of films and
Silver
they'd say,
Street,
some of them are sure to be profitable, except they won't.
Yes, Silver Screen Partners back in the
80s. Right. That's where they were letting podunk investors like me invest in Disney.
Yeah, the qualified investors, but yes. Yes.
Well, but the qualified, but it was very modest. They were going after regular Joes. They were not going after, you know, big moguls. No. They were going after little penny ante investors. Oh, everybody gets to invest in Silver Screens, and you're going to you invest a couple $1,000s and you'll have a piece of Hollywood magic.
Right, but then you have to actually go and Silver Screen Partners, which is probably an LLC, corporate, would have to then sue Touchstone or audit Touchstone Pictures to get an accurate accounting. Otherwise, you just have to kind of believe whatever Touchstone Pictures told you was the profitability. Well, now that accurate accounting is far more transparent due to the fact that Universal or Sony or Warner Brothers actually has to give that accounting to its partners, its ownership partners.
All right.
And so
what does this have to do with a little director?
Well, you know, if you're a little director, you're not going to have the resources most of the time to get an auditor, a forensic accountant, an accounting firm, possibly conduct the audit, hire a SWAT team of lawyers or just one or two lawyers to go and fight the studio. However, if you're legendary, you pretty much have that at your disposal, and Universal or any one of these studios is less inclined to, I don't want to say cook the books, but exaggerate some figures, if you will, when dealing with their co-financiers.
So you're saying directors might ride on the coattails of these big pocket investors because you've got these outside people being watchdogs on the studios and demanding a clear accounting. It's more likely that some directors or big actors will say, hey, I'll take a piece of this film because I believe now I have a better shot at getting a clear accounting and getting profits if such a thing is deserved.
Correct. But what I would say, and I think you might agree with me, is that if you're legendary or, again, any one of these co-financiers or the studio, you're in the business of building up your library and not giving away ownership in your films. The only reason you would do that is if you're trying to lay off some of the risk and you wanted talent that you could not afford, which is the case here with Boyhood and Richard Linklater.
No, it's not the case here. It's not that they wanted to make a big film and couldn't afford the talent. It's that this director wanted to get this film made and said, I will forego my fee.
Right.
This is just a labor of love. This has nothing to do with what we're talking about. This is a one-off little weird thing. It's not part of a trend. It's not because of Legendary or some other outside investors keeping watchdog on this. It's nothing to do with it. It's a weird little film that we're going to film a couple days a year over a 12-year span. Clearly, that's not a film anybody's saying, oh my God, we're going to make big bucks. Let's make this happen. And he said, well, never mind. Don't pay me, but I'll take a little piece of the film. That's all that happened here. It's not a harbinger of the future.
Well, as you saw, the last sentence of the story said, well, this may not be a trend in Hollywood. It may be a trend for Richard Linklater.
But it's not.
that's what,
it's not. Yeah. His next film, he is not taking a cut of the film.
Well, did
it
you
has
wanna...
worked for some people. Mel Gibson invested in his own film, The Passion of the Christ, because no one wanted to make it. A film in Aramaic? What are you, out of your mind, Mel? It made a gazillion dollars. Steven Soderbergh and Channing Tatum split the budget of Magic Mike. Male strippers, $6.5 million budget. They made a gazillion dollars. So it can work.
Well, it's actually, Soderbergh has been quoted as saying, I made more money off of Magic Mike than all of my other films combined.
Including Ocean's 11, 12, and 13.
Yes, so that should tell you something.
I don't know about that, really. Ocean's 11, 12, and 13?
Yeah, well, remember, he was a gun for hire. He was not, he was not a profit, well.
Right, but when you do the sequel and the second sequel, you're going to make good money at that point.
I would assume so, yeah.
Yeah, and all, but a lot of his other films were not big, profitable, geared films. He was always making odd, quirky little movies.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm not surprised to hear that. With an asterisk by the Ocean's films. Well, all right. So it's not a trend. Is there any trend in music? Is vinyl coming back?
I don't think so. Because let's face it. I mean, except for DJs who use vinyl to mix, and more
they really don't.
They're not. I was going to say and more. They're actually
they've got
using
their iPhone, or they've got digital files, or they've got CDs even.
Yeah, I mean that image of the DJ with his head cocked, his or her head cocked. To listen to the mix through a headphones as they kind of sync up the two turntables, that's going away because software's taking its place. CDs or digital files are more easily and automatically synced up. You can sync up these beats in a much more automated way.
But Jack White of the White Stripes is an old school kind of guy. He's got a funky little label down there in, is he Nashville?
Nashville, yes.
Yeah, right? What's happening with him?
Well, he has this label, Third Man Records, and he actually has kind of a pressing plant, if you will, or pressing machine where he can press records. So he releases his latest album, Lazaretto. It sells 138,000 copies in its first week, and it's
the number one album on Billboard.
Which I think, Michael, you would also call that number a pittance, but in these times, it's actually, well, it's pretty good. It opens number one on Billboard's album chart, and 40,000 of those copies of the 138,000 were vinyl LPs, but they weren't just regular vinyl LPs. They were, quote-unquote, ultra vinyl LPs.
Well, that's right. He puts a lot of care and craftsmanship into the vinyl LPs that he releases. Because what you have nowadays is a lot of record labels will put out vinyl because a new Pearl Jam album comes out, new Led Zeppelin, some people want the vinyl. And they put out crappy vinyl. This is what astonishes me. But this is what all my vinyl friend experts tell me, that they're putting out this crappy product. It's not well made. It's not good sounding. It's not like classic LPs where you put a lot of care in it. It's just, oh, it's on vinyl. And people buy it as a collectible to put it on their wall or whatever, but they're not really listening to it that much. And those that do say, you know what? This wasn't very well made. So that's kind of disappointing. But Jack Black does it right.
Jack Black? I don't think Jack Black
does. Jack White does it right. It's 180 gram vinyl, which a lot of them are, but he does it apparently with good quality vinyl. I don't know what the deal is, but lots of nice little touches. There's vinyl only hidden tracks. There's dual groove technology, which lets you play different intros for certain songs, depending where you put the needle down. I mean, all sorts of cool stuff are done on these LPs that really make them collectibles.
Yeah, well, and it's a 3-speed album. There's one of the hidden tracks, basically underneath the center label of the record.
That round little label in the middle.
Right. There are 2 different tracks, one of which plays at 78 RPM. So you have to actually adjust. You have to have a phonograph, a record player that can adjust to 78 revolutions per minute. And then one plays at 45 revolutions per minute, which is typically the speed for singles. You know, that was the 45 single. And uh-huh. Then, of course, the rest of the record plays at 33 and a third.
That's right.
A 3-speed record. And I found that to be interesting. The acoustic intro versus the I guess, you know, electric intro, as you mentioned, the dual groove technology.
It's all cool.
And side A plays from outside in and vice versa on the other. So it's cool. Interesting. Yeah.
And guess what? Almost a third of his entire sales were on vinyl. That's a lot of vinyl. That's a lot of his total sales. In fact, he may be number one because he put such care into the vinyl. Because fans who may have stolen a pirated copy or not cared to buy it all, copied it from their friends, said, oh, I want to get that vinyl album. That's really cool. It's a collectible. It's worthwhile. It's worth my money and time, unlike a digital copy. And so they bought it. And that added 40,000 copies to his total sales. He might have been number 2 or 3.
Yeah, well, and you know, there's no compression on the vinyl, and mixed and mastered differently, which is often the case, by the way. And what I find, we talked before we began recording about the interview that Jack White did in Rolling Stone and about how Third Man Records has this kind of, you know, press that can make records, and how everything they release gets scooped up by collectors. And what's interesting is people go in and they actually cut a record right there in the studio live.
Well, they have a little booth where you can do that. It's just not how he did his album. They have, you'd have these in places all over the country where you could go into a booth and record an LP saying, hi, Mom, I miss you. How are you?
Right.
And send off that LP to back home. In fact, Neil Young recorded his whole new album in that booth. It's kind of a lo-fi treat.
Yes.
But that's not how most acts are recording at his studio at Third Man. This is just a
correct
novelty item, really.
Yes.
Right. But he says, we're making money on it. You know, it's not just a vanity press. They're actually making money on their LPs because they're putting a lot of care into them, making, crafting really neat, fun collectibles, and people are responding. But again, it's not a trend. Vinyl is not coming back, even though a third of his total sales this week came from vinyl. That's pretty amazing. But overall, people are not suddenly going to flock to turntables.
Well, you know, he said that if he actually cared about turning Third Man Records into a profitable enterprise, it probably would have flopped and it probably wouldn't be doing as well. But he just didn't care. He didn't have to care.
That's right.
And so, as you say, it's probably, you know, vinyl and vinyl releases, not a trend per se, maybe a trend for Jack White.
That's right. Well, you know, it sent me to back to the Billboard website because I thought, oh, well, what's number one this week? Else, you know, number two, number three, wanted to look at the charts and get a feel for them. So I don't go to Billboard.com regularly anymore. And here's why, because I go back to Billboard.com. And what is the top featured story on the industry paper of record?
About Justin Bieber.
It's what's on your exercise playlist.
Yeah.
Their featured number one story is, oh, we spoke to Spotify and said, hey, look at playlists for exercise workout regimes and give us a list. It's like, oh, come on. It's sad. It's very sad. But I will say that they have finally launched Rolling Stone Country. They announced it on the cover of their latest issue of Rolling Stone. Miranda Lambert is on the cover. She had the number one album last week. And you know why they did it? Because 5 of the top 20 albums are by country artists like Miranda Lambert and Eric Church. So, you know, it should have been done 30 years ago. A good, you know, extension of the brand, but better late than never, I guess.
Yeah, no, and I liked the most recent Rolling Stone because they kind of go into why country is becoming so popular.
It's been popular for decades. It's not becoming popular.
But crossing over to...
No, it's been crossed over for decades.
You think so?
I don't know. No, please. You had Kenny Rogers, you had Urban Cowboy, you had Garth Brooks was the biggest act of the 90s. Country is not now crossing over. Country has been big for decades. It's often the number one radio format. You can't cross over if you're number one.
Well, maybe it's crossing over to number two.
Well, at number one on the singles chart, by the way, is Australian female rapper Iggy Azalea, to which I said, who?
Yeah,
I'm way behind on this stuff. Iggy Azalea is an Australian female rapper. Her number one song for the fourth week in a row is Fancy. And she's also on the number two song, which is by a young female artist called Ariana Grande. And her song is called Problem. So Iggy Azalea is on the number one and the number two spots simultaneously with her first two songs making the charts. That hasn't happened since the Beatles.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, that's kind of a nifty little detail there.
Well,
so,
now, do you know a group called Sylvan Esso?
Nope.
Okay, well, check them out. Worth checking out.
All right. Are they a big deal?
Well, I think they're becoming a big deal. But a second. If you said those two words together, deal and big, in the reverse order, big and deal, then it must be time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, talk show host Chelsea Handler is going to Netflix.
Beep.
This changes.
She likes to curse.
I know. I got it. For those of you who don't watch Chelsea Handler, she likes to curse. This changes everything, of course. Or maybe nothing. Netflix may be seen as more like a cable channel a la AMC and Comedy Central than a website streaming old movies and TV shows. Handler may compete with the big boys in late night again. Or she may be playing an entirely different game. Netflix may change its programming to mimic networks, or a talk show is just part of the mix that makes sense, just like Bill Maher and John Oliver make sense on HBO. She'll do 4 specials and then launch her show in 2016. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for her. It's a big deal for Netflix. It makes sense. It does sort of open your brain like, well, what are they? What is Netflix now? But it doesn't seem that odd when you think about it. You know, like I say, most of their programming that they've paid for, their original programming is stuff that you can watch, you know, 5 years from now, like, you know, House of Cards. If you get into the series and you want to watch from the beginning, there it is. But a talk show is as disposable as it gets.
I know people who've worked for HBO for years and they're in the, you know, they're in content and they have always looked at Netflix, at least since they have begun licensing for streaming purposes. They have looked at Netflix as a competitor. Mainly because their feeling is you can't license the content I was going after, making it impossible for me to license, and then say, you're not my competitor. You're my competitor.
Right. Yeah, they're definitely a competitor. And I think it just says, hey, people pay $8, $9 a month for Netflix, right? If Chelsea Handler makes some people happy to pay that fee, then it works. The money works. It doesn't matter if everybody watches Arliss on HBO, that old sports sitcom. I didn't like it. But some people loved it, and they were happy to pay for HBO every month just to get Arliss whenever it appeared. So if that's what Chelsea does for Netflix, makes some of their subscribers happy, brings in some new subscribers, and the money adds up, it's going to work out fine.
Where did you come up with Arliss? Like, out of all the shows?
Always wondered why Arliss was on.
Yeah, so did I, actually. In any case, big news on Broadway, where the musical Newsies is shutting down. Much like newspapers all over the country, by the way. But unlike most newspapers, Newsies is still profitable, having grossed $100 million on Broadway, and by the time it closes in mid-August, hitting the magical 1,000 performances, or really 1,005 to be exact. That puts the show based on a flop Disney film among the elite shows that have run about 2.5 years or more, a feat accomplished only by about 110 shows in history. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big, big whoop. You know, it's coming to the end of its run. I was waiting to see between Newsies and Once, which is another show that opened at the same time, and they both competed for Best Musical, and Once won, as it deserved to. I love that show. But they both look like they're at the end of their run. I was wondering who would close first. I frankly thought Once would be the one, but of course, as someone pointed out, Once has a much lower operating cost because the cast is the orchestra. They play their own instruments, and there's like 10 people on stage, whereas Newsies has about half the young male hoofers on Broadway are working at Newsies right now as a big, big cast.
Well, so frankly, I just can't wait for Transformers, the musical. are making that, right? Because every movie now has to have a musical, right?
Well, Newsies was a musical, so made perfect sense. Once was essentially a musical, so that too made perfect sense. But what is up next for Disney? They have Aladdin that just opened up doing great business.
Right.
They've got The Lion King still going strong. They're opening Shakespeare in Love, not a musical, but a drama. They're adapting that for the stage, opening that in London in July, and then they're taking another stab at the animated film, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. They're doing a live-action musical version of that movie, and they're opening that at, how do you say that?
La Jolla.
La Jolla, this fall, out in California. So we'll see after those go. What surprised me, though, in all the articles was nobody said, well, what show is going to move into that house? Because it's a Nederlander house. And when a show closes, that means there's a space open for somebody else. Come the fall, some new show will want that space where Newsies is playing. There are very few Broadway houses, and with all these long runners, they're all valuable, and they got to decide, who do we want to give the house to? And other people are angling to get that house. So it's kind of surprised I didn't find any word on which show might take over that space, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
You know, I would point out that the La Jolla Playhouse, which is where they're going to do The Hunchback of Notre Dame, or Notre Dame, depending on...
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame, yeah.
Not depending on whether you pronounce it properly or not.
Exactly. That's where I was headed with that statement. So it is kind of a well-known...
Oh, yeah. Launching pad.
Yeah. And Rent, for instance, showed there. The latest production of Jesus Christ Superstar was not necessarily launched
it's a touring production with big stars like Johnny Rotten.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Oh, and we've linked in the show notes to a hilarious story in Playbill about this Broadway show called Hands on a Hard Body. It was co-composed in part by Amanda Green, and it was set in Texas, the show, and now it opened on Broadway and flopped, but it got some Tony nominations, and it opened in Texas, and the director invited Amanda Green, said, come see the show. So, of course, she went, and she paid her own dime to go, and she goes to see the show. And he's completely redone the entire show, which you can't do. You got to get permission to change anything. He did everything different. He moved songs. He cut characters. He moved things from the first act to the... She's sitting there shell-shocked. She can't believe it because you can't do that. You're not allowed to. She's watching the show. She's dumbfounded. And at the end of the show, the director comes up to her and says, you got to admit it works better. And they immediately sent a cease and desist order.
You have to admit that's the law. That's what she said. Yeah. But, you know, just to goes to show you that, like, you can turn any film into a Broadway musical, Hands on a Hard Body, a documentary.
Yeah. And Transformers, maybe the musical will be coming.
That's true. Well, except, well, one hotel won't participate because mere days before the new Transformer film opens, it's Transformers film, not Transformer, right? I mean, that's pretty much...
You're right.
They're always plural. Well, minutes, days before it opens, a Chinese investment firm that is a sponsor of the film, which paid to have its products seen in the movie, product placement, they are now suing to cut off all ties. The owners of the Pangu Hotel, which is featured in the film, that's who we're talking about here. The company says its association with the film is a disaster and causing them some financial harm, and they are demanding the studio remove all images, logos, and references to the firm and its subsidiaries in marketing material and the film itself. Paramount said, in effect, what the f- Chelsea Handler? To be exact, they said the hotel is displayed beautifully in the film and they're working to resolve any concerns because, let's face it, the film is done, you bozos. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big one, but I wish I knew what it was. Why are they suddenly freaking out?
I have no
Why
idea.
Why are they not happy? Not a word in anywhere could I find explaining what the heck they're upset about. It's like it opens in a week. You can't say now. But that does raise the question. If for some reason you had to remove something from a film, and you're talking digital copies, Sperling, how would that work? How long would it take?
There have been, first of all, when you're talking about effects work and things like that, it could take quite a while.
Oh, yeah. You can't just snip out the film. Well, you could just cut out the scene, though, right? It's not like you're going to digitally erase it. You're just going to cut out every moment where you see that hotel. Say it's about, you know, 45 seconds of the entire film. Who knows? But you, when you just cut out that celluloid, so to speak, and that'd be it?
Well, yes, that's pretty much what you could do if, you know, you were insane.
And how would it be possible? Because it's a digital print.
Yes, it is, actually, because really what you would do, in fact, it would be possible, unlike with 35 millimeter, what would be possible with digital is that another composition playlist, a CPL, could be sent to each and every theater showing the film, which says, hey, skip these frames. Don't show these frames. Go from frame A to frame G. Don't show any of the others.
All right. Interesting.
It's kind of annoying, but yeah.
So legally speaking, actually, it is something that they can't say, oh, our hands are tied. It's already out in the world. It's too late. Maybe we can talk about home video. You know, practically speaking, it is something that can be done.
Yes, and it would be done in an automated fashion. You wouldn't be telling a projectionist to skip those frames. Right. The server would skip it.
Of course, of course.
Yes, however, there's, you know.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, no.
That's interesting, though. I can't wait to find out why they're angry.
Well, maybe it's because the hotel gets blown up or collapses. Everything.
What?
Hey, it's a Transformers movie. No city is left standing at the end of a Transformers movie. Now, Dr. Oz is so sorry. He was called before a Senate committee that treated him with kid gloves while condemning what the famous TV doctor or TV doc in a box, literally, does on his daytime talk show. Dr. Emmett Oz is confused. Just because he exclaims that products like green coffee are a miracle weight loss solution doesn't mean he's endorsing it. Yeah. Maybe he's been a little too enthusiastic, is what he thinks. Oz points out that he has never officially endorsed any of the questionable products that they're talking about and received no money, but the senator suggested perhaps he should know better. Oz promised to temper his words and try to do better. The senator said, gee, that would be nice, given your training and education and background, make it ludicrous for you to do what you do. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I was fascinated that they treated him so kindly. It's like they were afraid to condemn him. You know, he's like basically acting like a snake oil salesman. You know, it boosts ratings. It boosts the show. He gets to do a show and say, oh, miracle weight loss drug, which any reasonable doctor would know is total BS and should never be said. He's like, well, you know, but it's like, no, if you're out there saying this is a miracle weight loss, no, a miracle weight loss is exercising more and eating sensibly, period. Everything else is malarkey. So he knows it's malarkey. He's using it to goose ratings and do pop rated shows. And yet the senator seemed afraid to take on Doc Oz.
Well, I can tell you the reason that they're afraid is because they're kind of unsure just how popular he is or whether he's popular. They don't want to piss off their constituency.
Exactly.
And so they're like, wait, can I beat this guy up? Because I'd like to beat him up, but I don't want to do that if it's going to make me A, look bad, and B, cause a backlash that I don't
want. Little old lady who says, I'm not going to vote for you. But it's just like Dr. Sanjay Gupta, which was a joke that Obama was going to put him as attorney general. And
attorney general,
the surgeon general.
Yeah.
Attorney general. And thank God people raised a fuss and said, this guy is ridiculous. The junk he does on CNN and elsewhere promoting, you know, new age and holistic treatment and all that crap, you know, treating it like it's normal and reasonable stuff. Thank God they had to pull back on that one. Doc Oz is a little better. I might want to do my heart surgery, whatever he does, but as a TV doctor, he's a joke.
Is the Star Wars franchise determined to gain some film world credibility? They pick the hero Helmer of the Star Trek reboot, J.J. Abrams, to oversee the first film, only to see Abrams become tainted by the mixed reviews for the second Star Trek flick, the movie that kept them cooling their heels. So now they've named director Rian Johnson to do episode 8, the second in the new trilogy, starting with episode 7. Johnson wrote and directed the terrific film Brick, as well as the sci-fi flick Looper. They've also named Josh Trank of Chronicle and Gareth Edwards of Godzilla and Monster to helm two standalone flicks. So these aren't Star Wars flicks necessarily.
No, they're Star Wars flicks. They're like Boba Fett or whatever.
Yeah, they're spinoffs.
They are Star Wars movies.
They're spinoffs. They're not like episode 9.
No, it's Star Wars Boba Fett, Star Wars, you know, whatever. Those are absolutely Star Wars films.
What about Star Wars Keep the Peace? Star Wars Give Peace a Chance. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think they're smart choices. They seem to be really making an effort to choose young, up-and-coming talent, whether they think they can control them or whether they're just saying, hey, let's give these guys their head and let them make the best movies they can. If that's what they're doing, it'll work. And hopefully these guys will turn out some good movies. If they're hiring them because they're like, well, they're kind of cool, but they'll do what we tell them because it's their first really big film or second big film, then it won't work. But hopefully they'll let them do what they want and let them geek out over the Star Wars universe and make an actual good film. It'll be the first one since the early 80s.
Now, do you think that this portends or pretells, or I don't know what the correct word there
portends?
Is. Portends, thank you. Anything about J.J. Abrams' work on Episode 7, or do you think he just was like, nope, I'm just going to do this and I'm done. I'm out.
No, I know he'd already said he didn't want to do all three or whatever. Yeah, and they're making one a year, so they can't, you know.
Yes,
they're releasing one every year, so he can't do all three as such necessarily, unless he put his whole life on hold, you know.
Well, don't tell that to Peter Jackson.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's why I recanted what I was saying.
Well, the future of Sesame Street may be digital. The acclaimed show from the Children's Television Workshop is still airing all the time on PBS, but the hour-long edition broadcast each weekday morning is looking more and more like an outlier all the time. So the afternoon broadcast is being trimmed to half an hour, and, perhaps more tellingly, the half-hour edition will be available via streaming on the PBS website, the PBS Roku channel, and via their mobile app. And that mobile app is where all the growth in viewership is taking place. And this is a quote, 30 minutes is about as long as you can get. And this was said by Leslie Rotenberg, PBS's general manager of children's programming, and she told that to the New York Times. She went on to say the hour-long show didn't lend itself as well to that. Of course. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal. I would say Leslie Rotenberg would be a better name for a woman doing children's programming. She sounds like a villain. Rotenberg.
Okay.
Then Rotenberg. You said it the nicer way. But I don't know how her name is pronounced, and God bless her. She's doing nice work at PBS. But anyway, it's just telling that mobile apps and streaming, and that's where, you know, the future is. You know, that's just very telling to me that Sesame Street is getting a lot of growth and a lot of play on their mobile app, which is proving very successful. And that's where kids are watching more and more programming. They're just taking a tablet, pressing a button, and suddenly you got an episode of Sesame Street to watch. Well, I hate to think that kids can't sit still for an hour, though. I know I did.
How about, like, give them a book to read?
Well, that too. It's a part of a Sesame Street can be part of a useful mix of childhood programming.
Jay Leno is going to receive the prestigious Mark Twain Comedy Award. He joins past recipients like Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, Lily Tomlin, Jonathan Winters, George Carlin, Tina Fey, Carol Burnett, and Steve Martin. The ceremony takes place at the Kennedy Center in October, assuming Leno can squeeze that in amidst, you know, 200-plus dates of touring each year. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. In general, I was going to be a little catty and talk about whether Jay Leno and Whoopi and there was one or two others like Will Ferrell, really, the Mark Twain Award, you know, whether they were deserving or not, but whatever. The guy's been doing it for 30 years in television and on the road, so, you know, he's getting the award. But I would take the moment to say I was probably wrong, I think, about Late Night. You know, we got to wait 2 years to see where it all falls out. We still got, you know, people to debut, like Stephen Colbert will debut in Late Night. We got other people coming into the mix. But as far as getting rid of Jay and bringing in Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel from 12 to 11:30 and all that stuff, I objected to it all because he was number one. But short term, as far as we can tell right now, it seems to be working out well for everybody, for NBC, for ABC. They're all doing well.
You know who it's not doing well for?
CBS?
Jay Leno.
Oh, okay.
A lawsuit that may go all the way to the Supreme Court has huge implications for the entertainment industry and freelancers in general. Jack Kirby is one of the greats in the comic book world. For years, he was key in creating or helping to create iconic characters like Spider-Man, X-Men, The Incredible Hulk, and The Mighty Thor, you know, all for Marvel, all while not actually working for the company. He bought his own supplies, worked at home, and turned in his work to the company, which then paid a flat fee. Marvel insists it was all work for hire, but the crazy heyday of the comic book world makes that a tenuous claim, just as the music industry is on shaky ground when it insists that so many artists who recorded classic best-selling albums were in fact just doing work for hire for the labels as well, and don't deserve to reclaim their copyrights now or, what is that on the
calendar? Ever.
Oh, ever. Yes, ever. Yes. Or as the labels like to say, never. You will never reclaim your copyright. Kirby's case is hoping to be aired in front of the Supreme Court, and just got an interesting boost from a Clinton-era head of the Patent and Trademark Office that sides squarely with Kirby. The Hollywood Reporter has a good analysis of the subject, which we will link to in our show notes. So, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but a big deal if it gets to the Supreme Court and if they rule in his favor. I'm probably biased to artists. I think there's just a difference between saying, hey, build me that brick wall or build me that fence around my yard versus create something. And, you know, when you're creating something and you're doing it on your own and they help release it, the idea that you have no stake or ownership in it seems a little more tenuous. Or the fact that they stamped Jack Kirby's checkbook and said, oh, by the way, this isn't your work, it's our work.
Yeah,
you know, if he cashes the check, they're like, see, no, you cash the check. That means it's all ours.
Yeah. On the back of the checks that Marvel sent to Jack Kirby, they would say, you agree by endorsing this check that your work was work for hire and that you own no copyright, you know, basically that you've signed away. And so there's some question over the legality of that.
That's right. People can make you sign stuff like the agreements when you sign up for iTunes. It doesn't mean it's legally binding.
That's right.
And we should have said this with Jack White when we were in the music section. But speaking of artists like Jack Kirby and Jack White and multimedia artists, you've got Bjork. We talked about her last week or the week before. The MoMA took her app and put it in their permanent collection. Well, no surprise, they followed that up by saying, let's do a retrospective of Bjork's career. And that's going to be taking place at MoMA in 2015.
I don't know. What do you do? You get the goose dress or the swan dress?
Absolutely. Of course. There's tons. There's video. There's costumes. There's music. There's artwork involved around the albums and the videos. There's lots to do.
Okay. Well, remember when Baywatch was the most watched TV show in the world?
I do.
Well, the new number one drama turns out to be the CBS crime drama NCIS, the International Television Audience Award. Say that 10 times fast. They estimate NCIS is seen by some 58 million people around the globe, including about 20 million in the U.S. alone. They draw on data from 66 countries with a potential 3 billion viewers. So obviously NCIS has some room to grow. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's always good to be number one, right? Number one in the world. But boy, only 68 million. How many? 58 million people watching it. I thought it'd be a lot more. I mean, it's like 22 million in the U.S. alone when you talk about DVR and next day and all that stuff. So I'm surprised it's not like 200 million.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is a show about the U.S. Navy. So maybe it doesn't play well in Russia.
But it could be any show. I'm just surprised that the number one drama in the world only reaches about 60 million people.
And I'm sure that there are some industry watchers or, you know, industry professionals that would say, are you kidding? In this day of fractured attention spans and,
true.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop and brings us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Well, Sperling, let me do the talking because I'm going to ask you what this is all about because I don't know.
Well, here's how it will affect everybody. You won't be able to see music videos on YouTube for indie acts like, I don't know, Vampire Weekend and, I don't know, a number of others. Jack White. In fact, Adele, Arctic Monkeys.
But aren't they on major labels? Jack White is distributed by Columbia, at least.
And yes, distributed by. But the copyright, who owns that copyright? It's Third
Man
Records.
What's going on here? YouTube is like practically the number one source for music for a lot of people right now. You want to hear a song? Not even you want to see the video. You want to hear a song or you're wondering what a song sounds like? A lot of people go to YouTube, type in the artist and or the song, and they start to play it.
Right. And some of these labels, be it Universal Music or Third Man Records, they're making a lot of money by being partners with YouTube.
Google. Not a lot. It's starting to be a reasonable revenue stream, but it's no makeup for all the money they lost in sales.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yeah. No, I wouldn't say that. No. It's beginning to make, as Google says, hundreds of millions of dollars for record companies. But YouTube wants to start its own streaming service and they want it to be. You know, they don't want to play ads during it. And so they are kind of forcing the issue.
I see. So right now, if you watch a video, you're looking at an ad, either like a 15-second video before the song begins.
Right.
Or there's an ad next to it and above it and below it. And they're saying, hey, pay us whatever, $10 a month, and you can watch all the videos you want and not have to see any ads.
Right. And so all of these record companies have become partners with Google and YouTube, and they share in the revenue from the ads. And what YouTube is doing is they're starting this ad-free streaming music service, and they are taking all of their partners and telling them they have to sign this new licensing agreement to actually be a part of that. Otherwise, if they don't sign it, then YouTube won't have the license for to play the content. So third man, if you don't sign this licensing agreement, which 90%, according to the Financial Times, which is where this story was first reported, according to the Financial Times, 90% of the music industry has already signed this. However, you know, if you don't, then we won't have the license to show your music video, and then you'll be losing, you know, promotional. The
I'm
promotional
confused.
Edge.
Are they taking it off the streaming service or YouTube entirely?
Taking it off YouTube entirely.
So if you want to be seen on free YouTube, you have to license your music for our streaming service.
That's effectively what they're saying. And that, well, that's not effectively. That is what is being claimed here. That is exactly what is being claimed here. And YouTube has not denied it.
And I assume, well, no, nobody's questioning whether that's what's happening.
Initially, there was some question because YouTube hadn't said anything. But
no, and not anymore.
Not anymore.
So my question is, are the terms that they're offering not good? Or, I mean, if most people have signed up, I assume that whatever cut they're getting of the streaming music service is going to be good, right? I mean,
well,
or what's the deal? What's the bugaboo? Is it just there's so many people with little labels that they haven't signed up yet? Or is it that they object to the terms that YouTube is offering?
Well, the Worldwide Independent Music Industry Network, there was, which is called WIN, there was some question. They took the case to the European Union. They're saying, you know, we're, you know, being forced to sign these terms.
They're saying YouTube is like a monopoly.
Yeah.
As far as music video playing online, and therefore them forcing us to sign this means that they're behaving in a monopolistic, anti-competitive fashion.
And that they're not giving fair terms. They're not giving fair terms effectively. The record label licensing agency Merlin estimates that indies account for about 32.6% of the music market, of recorded music industry sales.
That's a lot higher than it ever was before, wasn't it?
Yes, way higher. And to answer your question directly, Michael, a memo which The Verge published, or at least detailed, was leaked. And Believe Digital, which is an indie label out of the EU, they say, look, YouTube gave all of these big record companies the same deal they gave us. So we're all on levels.
But maybe you don't like the deal.
And yes. Yeah, so, but what they're saying is it's not like the big labels got a sweetheart deal and now they're kind of jamming, you know, bad terms down our throats. They were all the same. And that they were on par with the terms that we have with Spotify, Deezer, and Ardio. So it's not like they're so much worse than what Spotify is giving us. They're kind of the same.
Well, but Spotify's deal sucks.
Well,
right?
Exactly.
Isn't that what most people would say?
That's another story entirely.
well, that's this story.
What the memo goes on to say is that these new licensing terms, this new contract, and this is a quote, includes a significant increase of the revenue share rate on UGC, user-generated content, for sound recording. This type of use is currently the largest source of revenues from YouTube. Now, user-generated content, you'd think, well, you know, a music video isn't user-generated content. Oh, but yes, it is, because the record label uploads it. So it's
YouTube doesn't make it. Yeah,
exactly. So it's so they're saying, I'm sorry, even though it's user generated content, we don't have the license to play this user generated content because you're not agreeing to the new license terms.
We're not confused by that. They're not being cute. We understand. They won't play it unless you agree to sign on to their music streaming service, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not confusing. Are they going to keep ad-supported videos online at all, or will you only be able to watch videos if you pay a monthly streaming service fee?
What they're basically saying is, we want this music streaming service. We don't want somebody to be able to listen to, I don't know, the Rolling Stones.
If you're not part
of
the service, you can't have ad-supported videos either.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And right now, that is a large revenue stream for some of these indie record labels.
Aren't they just doing business? Is this evil or is this just business?
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. I think that if they basically gave favored nations, saying everybody's getting the same deal, and oh, by the way, that deal is on par with what is it our industry standards.
The crappy deals that you got with Spotify and Pandora.
Yes, we're giving favored nations for crappy deals, then it's all fair. Then the independent labels should kind of figure that out, and they will eventually come around. If they wanted
so they should
more,
slit their own, they should be quiet and slit their own throats. Maybe you're an indie label that says, I don't want to be part of any streaming service. Maybe that's why you're indie.
Okay, well, then...
Then you're not going to be on YouTube.
Then you're not going to be on YouTube. That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
Yep.
So,
and since YouTube is so big, is that anti-competitive and monopolistic? You know, if you've got such a big platform that the whole world is using it, And then you say, but if you don't sign up for this secondary business over here, we're going to block you from that main business. Is that anti-competitive and monopolistic? I think it might be. YouTube might be so big, you don't get to do the things that smaller companies would do.
Yeah, I guess the argument YouTube would make is you could still put that video on your own website. You could still distribute it elsewhere on Dailymotion or something.
But we're saying YouTube is such a big commons. It's such a big worldwide space that forcing you to take part in a secondary business to be able to be on that worldwide space is not fair.
It's
not too big. It's too much of a public green space.
I'm not familiar enough with that kind of law.
Oh, that's nothing to do with the law. I'm just talking, you know, BSing.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if a website or a thing can become so big and so omnipresent that, hey, now you're Facebook and now you want to say if I don't want to sell off the baby photos that I post on Facebook, then I can't show any photos at all? Well, wait a second. I don't want my baby photos to be used in ads and other places on Facebook. I don't want to have to take part in that. And they tell me, well, if you don't let us access your photos and use them in ads, you don't get to be on Facebook. I would get angry about that, right? That was what Facebook had an argument with their customers.
Right.
Right? Right now you have to opt in, right? That's what they did. Is YouTube so big that they don't get to say that? Oh, you got to take part in this other business over here. Like, you know, we're over here, but if you want to take part in that business, you better sign up or we'll cut you out of the main space. Maybe they're too big to do that anymore.
I don't know. I mean, certainly there is precedent where businesses who are selling one product cannot force people to buy another.
But it sounds like what they might be doing here.
Exactly.
All right.
So I don't know. I'm not well-versed enough to go.
What's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me that it is really bad PR.
And we have such legally grounded guts, don't we?
Yes.
So anybody want to weigh in, make sure you call or email us, right?
Right. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. The email address, again, is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that is, in fact, what David Knight did.
All right. Well, Sperling, David Knight, thank you for writing to us. He emailed this and directed it to you alone. He didn't even say hi to me. Nothing, not a word.
Now, in all fairness, I happen to know David, so.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So he's a professional.
Full disclosure.
Personal or professional acquaintance.
And by the way, he would be able to answer the YouTube question, by the way.
All right. Well, I guess I will take the role of David and address this email to Sperling, not Michael. Sperling, in episode 237, you state with the utmost certainty that the Beats contracts with the labels cannot be transferred to Apple. Unless you've seen the contracts yourself, you can't know this for a fact. But that overstatement is forgivable, and that we both know that entertainment lawyers that the labels would have used would certainly not have neglected to include a provision that Beats cannot assign the contract. However, the next step of your discussion misses the nuance that is important here, as you imply that Apple could not make use of the Beats contracts and would need to negotiate with the labels, but with the advantage of knowing the Beats contract. Transferability, or more specifically, assignability, would be the important concept if Beats was assigning the contracts to another party. But Apple has purchased Beats as a going concern, and the company Beats will continue to exist as an entity. The contracts between that entity and the labels will remain valid and can continue to be used by Beats unless the contracts include a change of control provision, which says that the labels can terminate if the ownership of Beats changes. While such a clause would not be unheard of, it is often more restricted in scope. For example, the label might want the ability to terminate the contract if Beats came to be controlled by one of the label's competitors. But Beats certainly would have pushed back against a broad change of control clause that limits their ability to sell the company generally. In all likelihood, then, the contracts will remain in force between the labels and Beats, which will operate as a subsidiary of Apple. Perhaps the need to operate the contracts under the Beats entity and other restrictions in the contracts are even contributing factors to Apple's decision to continue to operate the streaming service under the Beats name rather than rebranding it Apple. David Knight. All right, Sperling, what do you say?
I say everything he says is correct. When I said that whole bit about the Beats contracts, in the back of my mind, I was thinking,
you may be wrong, you may be wrong, you may be wrong.
Yeah, I was like, not that I've seen the contracts, but I'm assuming that there's, you know, that you can't assign the contract to a new entity. That was kind of, so, you know, it's one of those like givens that if it's not in a contract, an entertainment industry contract, and many contracts, not just in the entertainment industry, you kind of wonder what the lawyer was thinking. Uh-huh. And everything he's saying is absolutely correct.
Well, the only thing I don't know about is operating under the name of Beats. I think that's just they spent billions of dollars to buy Beats. Beats is cool. Beats has got a viable name. That's you know, part of the hip factor of it. Why change it to Apple? You know, Apple doesn't have a hip name for streaming music or headphones. So keep the Beats names. It's valuable. Why would you get rid of it?
Yeah, that's just a bonus.
Right. But as far as, you know, the contract's forcing you to do that, I don't think that's it so much as even if they weren't, it makes sense not to dilute the brand of Beats. You know, at most you might say Beats by Apple or Beats with Apple or something like that. Apple Beats, which sounds like Applebee's, the restaurant, which is not where we're going to be dining after the show. But when we are dining after the show and sharing drinks and talking about how the show went Sperling, when the people who want to like us on Facebook or follow us or trend us or email us, what should they do?
Well, if you want to be like David Knight of Bardo Media and email us, again, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free and aggregate podcasts. Please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, to contact us, or even follow us, as you mentioned, Michael. Our Twitter handle is @showbizsandbox, and our Facebook page can be found if you just search for Showbiz Sandbox. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. So again, all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a revolving website from week to week. This week, Michael, what is it?
It's, on the other hand, jaylenoisfunnierthanme.com.
And you know what? If you want to actually read some stuff that Michael's written, try going to, I don't know, michaelgiltz.com or the Huffington Post. You can find some of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.